Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Over 2 million people worldwide and about 400,000 people in the United States are currently living with multiple sclerosis. This disease often affects young adults and, curiously, is more common at higher latitudes. My guest today is Dr. Barbara Geiser. She's clinical professor of neurology and clinical director of the multiple sclerosis program at UCLA. She's spent almost 30 years of her life caring for patients with multiple sclerosis. In Anchorage, if you've got questions or comments, you can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, you can email me at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Dr. Geiser, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you, Dr. Woodard. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's get down to basics. What is multiple sclerosis?
Multiple sclerosis turned out to be the most common cause of neurologic impairment in young people after trauma. And it's a disease that affects the central nervous system, which is the brain, the spinal cord, and optic nerves. What happens is that nerves are basically electrical cables. They're wires or axons that are covered with an insulating material called myelin. And what happens in MS is that this myelin and then the nerve fiber itself becomes scarred. So it's like having a frayed wire, and the nerves cannot conduct electrical impulses appropriately. So if a muscle isn't getting an appropriate electrical stimulus, it'll be weak. If a sensory end organ isn't getting an appropriate electrical message, you might have numbness or abnormal sensation. If the optic nerves are damaged, you won't get appropriate visual information. So the MS Society had a phrase that MS kind of short-circuits you, and I think that's an apt description.
Are the lesions in the myelin punctuated areas, just scattering around, or they involve all the myelin in one particular nerve? What's happening in that frame of reference?
Well, as I said, MS affects nerves in pretty much any part in the brain, the spinal cord, or in the optic nerves. Now, in some portions of the brain, the lesions appear to be concentrated somewhat more in some areas than the other. In very heavily myelinated areas, for example, there's a big bundle of myelinated fibers called the corpus callosum, which connects the right half to the left half of the brain. We tend to see MS lesions there. We tend to see MS lesions along next to a normal fluid-filled cavity in the brain called the ventricle. So there certainly are some areas where the lesions have a predilection for, and some others appear to be somewhat more random. But basically, it's the central nervous system. So, for example, MS does not affect the peripheral nerves, which are the nerves that run out in our arms and legs.
Are there central nervous system areas with myelin that seem to be unusually spared?
Again, I think that we tend to have an appreciation more for myelin that tends to be more affected. I don't know that there are any areas that are preferentially spared per se.
Okay. I was just thinking along what causes things, and maybe we get some hints by noticing areas that are not affected. So who is affected by this? We've mentioned young adults. Is it primarily young adults?
Mm-hmm. This is sort of an ageist disease, if you will. It tends to affect people generally between 20 and 50, although certainly there are people who have it on either side of that curve. It's a sexist disease. It affects women about 2 to 1. It's a racist disease. It tends to affect people who are Caucasian more than other ethnic groups. So there's clearly kind of a profile. And so if you were to take a textbook typical person with MS, it would be a young woman in her 20s or 30s, Caucasian, perhaps with some Scandinavian or Northern European ancestry.
How about children? Can children be affected?
Children can, and in fact, there are several pediatric centers of excellence that have been funded over the past couple of years because children get it, and they appear to be a little bit different. The male-female ratio, especially in children under 10, seems to be a little bit more equal. You don't see this female predominance. They can certainly have many of the same symptoms. Their course may be a little different. So this is an area of a lot of clinical interest and a lot of specialized centers in caring for the special needs of these kids.
And in our discussion before we came on the air, you mentioned pregnancy is an important issue as well.
Yes, because we've just said that the type of person who gets MS tends to be a young woman, and the thing that young women very commonly do is want to get pregnant and have families. Now, back in the bad old days, before the time of enlightenment, women with MS were told not to have children because it was thought it would make their MS worse, and it turns out that almost the opposite is true. And in order to understand this, we might want to talk a little bit about what we think causes the lesions in MS. MS is very widely held to be an autoimmune disease. It's a disease where the immune system, instead of defending the body, or in this case, defending the central nervous system, goes on kind of a search and destroy mission. The immune system gains access to the central nervous system and starts causing damage to the myelin and the nerves. Well, during pregnancy is a very immunomodulated state. The immune system is kind of turned down. And the reason for that, if you think about it, is pretty obvious. A developing baby, a developing fetus, has proteins on it that are foreign to the mother because half of them come from the father. And so if we were not programmed to turn down our immune systems during pregnancy, our immune systems would reject this foreign entity, the baby, and we wouldn't be very good at reproducing. So when women with MS are pregnant, it's a very immunomodulated state, and it turns out that the occurrence of exacerbations during pregnancy goes down by about two-thirds. Now, you get a little bit of sort of a rebound effect, and immediately after pregnancy, the relapse rate spikes up for about the first roughly 6 months or so postpartum, and then it goes back to pre-pregnancy levels. But the important thing to know is that when they do studies, that pregnancy does not appear to confer long-term disability. In other words, if a woman with MS becomes pregnant, she may be more likely to have an attack immediately postpartum, but there are no data that she will incur increased long-term disability, and there are some data that suggest that becoming pregnant may even be protective, that women with MS who become pregnant may actually do a little better long-term. So the long and short of it is that women with MS who want to become pregnant, we don't tell them not to do this anymore.
Let me take just a second to remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1. My guest today is Dr. Barbara Geisner. She is the clinical director of the Multiple Sclerosis Program at UCLA. If you have questions or comments during the program today, you can reach us by calling us locally at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. All right, so let's, unless there's some other of this epidemiology, who gets it, when do they get it, and so forth, let's talk about symptoms a little bit.
So because MS can affect pretty much any spot in the central nervous system, you can pretty much have any symptom that is a result of neurologic dysfunction. The most common symptoms that somebody might start with would be numbness or tingling or prickling feelings. They may develop temporary loss of vision or impaired vision in one eye. That's called optic neuritis. They may have trouble with their balance. They may have weakness. Actually, it turns out that among people who have MS, the most common symptom, the symptom that in some studies is reported by up to 90% of people with MS, is fatigue. And it's not the, you know, I stayed up all night, late all night studying and I have to have a nap type of fatigue. It's a bone-crushing, debilitating fatigue that prevents people from functioning. And it's kind of interesting. We've only appreciated it probably for about 25, 30 years. We're not entirely sure what causes it, but it's the most common symptom of MS. People with MS very commonly have genitourinary dysfunction. That is that they can have trouble with their bladder or their bowel or their sexual function. They can have depression. They can have cognitive changes. So pretty much any function that the central nervous system controls.
We haven't, at least if we did, my mind was distracted, talked about the origin of these symptoms and use the word autoimmune too much. What, is this a truly an autoimmune disease? And if so, what do we mean by that?
Most people would hold that this is an autoimmune disease, that this is a disease where the pathophysiology, in other words, what causes the nerve damage, is a result of aberrant immune activity. And again, normally our immune systems are programmed to defend the self, to attack outside influences, germs or viruses or anthrax or whatever the world throws at us, and they protect what they are programmed to recognize as self. And in an autoimmune disease, and it's very interesting because there are over 80 autoimmune conditions, and again, about three-quarters of the people who get autoimmune conditions are women, the immune system gets the wrong message. The immune system thinks that some part of the body is a foreign entity, and it becomes programmed to recognize and start attacking that entity. Other common autoimmune diseases are some forms of thyroid disease, some forms of diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, inflammations of blood vessels, diseases like lupus. These are all held to be autoimmune diseases.
So that states like pregnancy or medications that affect the immune system can improve the symptoms in the course of this illness, which would lead more evidence to the fact that that is the reason for this problem.
Yes, that's a very good conclusion to draw. And in fact, right now, the main standard drugs that we generally start people on in terms of what we call disease-modifying therapy are what we call immunomodulatory agents. They don't wipe out the immune system, but they modify the immune system's ability to get in and attack the nerves. And again, as we said, pregnancy itself is an immunomodulated state.
I jumped off of the symptoms too quickly because I wanted to bring in this autoimmune issue. But is there a fairly typical presentation? Is there a clustering of a couple of symptoms? You mentioned fatigue being 90% and maybe visual disturbances, maybe a genital urinary thing. Is there an almost pathognomonic, and that's a medical term, means, boy, it's almost nothing else, kind of symptom group that would really make you think about multiple sclerosis?
Again, the symptoms you mentioned are fairly common as initial symptoms, although, again, things like fatigue and numbness and tingling are so could be caused by so many other things, and generally, especially initially, the symptoms come and go. So one very typical scenario might be a young, otherwise healthy woman who gets some numbness and tingling in her hands and feet for a few weeks, but she's otherwise okay and she doesn't think anything of it. And then maybe several months after that, she starts to notice, boy, you know, I'm really tired, but, you know, maybe she thinks she's just been working too hard or staying up too late at night. And then maybe she wakes up one day and loses the vision in one eye. And at that point, if she came to a neurologist, as you say, that sort of constellation of things would be almost pathognomonic. Now, again, there is no one pathognomonic. There is no one surefire symptom or sign or lab test or MRI finding that says this can only be MS. So you do have to try to exclude some other conditions that could cause these. And again, some of the conditions that we commonly look for that might simulate some of these symptoms and also might produce some of the findings on MRI would be some of these other autoimmune conditions, these vasculitides, inflammations of blood vessels, things like lupus, Lyme disease sometimes looks like MS. Back in the 80s, when I first started to work with this, we saw some people that we diagnosed with MS that retrospectively most likely had HIV, but we didn't know about HIV back then. Vitamin B12 deficiency can produce demyelination. So there's sort of a list of things that we look for, but quite frankly, it almost never turns out to be those. It usually turns out to be MS, but it doesn't mean that inappropriate of individuals, it isn't a good thing to look.
Mm-hmm. Since women are affected a little bit more commonly in these with this and other autoimmune diseases, that's one line of thinking that might lead one to think there's some genetic predisposition. Is there other evidence to suggest there's something about an individual's genetic makeup that may predispose them to this problem in particular?
There certainly is a genetic component to MS, and there are a lot of much smarter people than I that are working on this. Some of the evidence we know, for example, is that monozygotic twins, identical twins, twins that come from the splitting of one egg, have a much higher incidence of both of them getting MS than non-siblings or what we call dizygotic twins, where the twins come from more than one egg. Also, there are certain populations where there seems to be more MS, and these populations have different genetic makeups than populations where there are less MS. But the genetic story is pretty complicated, and we haven't teased out all the factors. Also, there are many components of the immune system that are under genetic control. One example of this is that exposure to Epstein-Barr virus seems to be one of the things that may be necessary for developing MS. Almost everybody who has MS turns out to have positive titers to Epstein-Barr, but so does about 90% of the population in general, and most people don't have MS. So you have to postulate that there are some environmental factors that, if they occur in the setting, in the appropriate genetic setting, that is most likely what leads to the development of the autoimmunity.
Epstein-Barr virus being one of the group of herpetic viruses that this particular one, Epstein-Barr, causes mononucleosis.
Right. There are some data that suggest, and again, I am not saying that Epstein-Barr causes MS. I'm just saying that exposure to it at a critical time point, exposure to it before late adolescence, seems to increase or seems to be associated with developing MS in a genetically appropriate individual, perhaps, and perhaps with other environmental exposures as well.
So it sounds like this, at times, could be a maybe difficult diagnosis. I can envision patients where, since it's maybe very, very slowly progressive, that it may be difficult at the beginning to be absolutely sure what you're dealing with.
Sometimes it's a little tricky, and again, because there is no one pathognomonic symptom or lab test or MRI findings, we basically make rules. And the guidelines, the quintessential guidelines, are that you have to demonstrate objective evidence, meaning you either have to see something on an MRI, and or you have to see something in spinal fluid, and or you have to see something on the patient's exam that indicates damage to the nerves in the central nervous system in more than one place and at more than one point in time, and you have to rule out these other diseases. So it's basically lesions in the central nervous system separated in space and time and no alternative explanation. And sometimes that's very easy to do, and sometimes it takes a little while. And sometimes you have to take a little bit of a wait-and-see attitude. Sometimes you have people where the symptom may suggest MS, or maybe they've had one attack, or maybe there isn't quite enough on the MRI. And often if you follow these people, it will declare itself.
Mm-hmm. So your experience is that if some of these are there, some of the symptoms are there despite a negative workup, that often it's just too early, and that later you would expect something more to develop.
That's very often the case, although, again, if somebody presents mm-hmm. just with symptoms, but they have a completely normal exam, completely mm-hmm. normal MRI, completely normal spinal fluid, I think it's much less likely. The flip side of that is that people are beginning to describe kind of the opposite, which is somebody who either maybe hits their head, or they have a headache, or they get an MRI of their brain for some reason other than looking for MS, and when they look at the MRI, they've got spots, and it's, whoa, these really look like MS, but we have no symptoms, and we have no clinical findings, and that's called radiologically isolated syndrome. And this is just brand new. It's just been described over the past year or two, and I think we're going to have to get some more information on these folks and see who's going to go on to develop MS.
All right, so that's an important issue, is sometimes there are findings done on tests that physicians do that are found spuriously and not related to the reason for necessarily the study. And then what do they mean? And in this case, lesions on an MRI that may look like MS are found, but the patient doesn't have anything. We don't know what really, I hear you saying, we're not sure what that means right now.
Right. Now, again, for example, you could do a spinal tap on these patients, and if they had spinal fluid findings indicative of MS, you might predict that these people are more likely to go on to develop clinically definite MS. But I think this needs some more study. But it's just that's sort of the flip side of somebody with symptoms and no findings is somebody with at least radiologic findings and no symptoms.
Okay. Once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Barbara Geiser. She's a clinical professor of neurology and the clinical director of the multiple sclerosis program at UCLA. We're talking about multiple sclerosis, and we'll get into some of the treatment in a little bit. But if you've got questions or comments about what you're hearing today, please give us a call. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@kska.org. Maybe you've answered this specifically, but are the imaging findings then not absolutely specific? And I'm talking about the MRI, I guess, in particular. Is there anything absolutely, again, pathognomonic about certain findings, and then maybe other findings that you're not so certain are related?
Again, in terms of, and again, for I'm going to take the liberty of repeating for your listeners who may not be familiar with the term. When we have a pathognomonic finding in medicine, it means it always means one disease, and it only means that disease. And we haven't got a lot of them. And unfortunately, we don't have one for MS. Having said that, there are MRI characteristics of lesions that are very, very commonly associated with MS. And when we look at it, we say, well, you know, this isn't pathognomonic, but boy, it sure looks like it. So some of those characteristics are, again, sort of location lesions in the white matter in and around the ventricles, which is a normal fluid-filled space in the brain, lesions in and around the corpus callosum, lesions in the brainstem, lesions in the optic nerve. The lesions tend to be kind of oval, and when they're oriented perpendicularly to these ventricles, so the ventricles have sort of a vertical orientation if you slice through the brain, and then if these lesions are oriented perpendicularly to them, they actually have a name. They're called Dawson's fingers, and when you see that, that again, certainly makes you think a lot about MS. Again, the flip side of that is that MS is not the only thing that causes white spots on an MRI. And so very often I will get referred to a patient who, as we're talking, you know, maybe they had a headache or they blacked out or something, and somebody does an MRI and there are a couple little white spots, and somebody goes, oh my goodness, they're white spots, this is MS. And so the take-home lesson here is not every white spot is MS, because lots and lots of things cause white spots. There are white spots and there are white spots. The other thing there are black spots. And so when you look at an MRI, you get different images depending on the sequence. And what you see commonly in MS, especially in old lesions, in lesions where there's been damage to the nerve wire, the axon as well as the myelin, instead of a white spot, you get a black hole. And again, those tend to be associated with kind of chronic burnt out MS lesions.
I mentioned at the start of the show that it's felt that multiple sclerosis is more common at higher latitudes, both in the northern and the southern hemisphere, if I'm correct. Is that still felt to be true? Is that a true statement? And if so, what hints about the disease does that lead us to?
Yeah, that's a great question, because we've known for decades that as you say, in the United States and worldwide, there's a higher incidence and a higher prevalence of MS in colder climates the farther away you get from the equator. And there were some migration studies that were done back in the beginning of the 20th century that said if you're born in, say, a high-risk area, if you're born in a northern climate and you move to a southern climate before age 15, you lower your risk. You assume the risk of your new southern homeland, and if you move after age 15, you retain the risk of your birthplace. And so we've known about this for 40, 50 years, but nobody's come up with a good explanation. And over the past, I guess, 5 to 10 years, we're beginning to get some very tantalizing hints to why this might happen. Turns out that vitamin D status is very seems to be associated with risk of developing MS. That is, people with lower vitamin D levels, people who were exposed to less sunlight when they were growing up, i.e. before puberty, before age 15 or so, have a higher risk of MS. Furthermore, once you develop MS, lower vitamin D levels seem to be associated with increased relapse rate. And it turns out vitamin D has very powerful effects on the immune system. So vitamin D is an immune modulator. And again, this sort of turns out to be at least intuitively kind of an attractive hypothesis. In the northern climates, there's less sunlight, there's weaker sunlight, you make less vitamin D, and so you have these lower vitamin D levels, and you're more predisposed to this autoimmune phenomenon. So this is very interesting, and there's a lot of work going on in this area. We are starting to check vitamin D levels in our patients, I think, much more than we used to. We are trying to keep the levels within normal range.
So, in a sense, vitamin D works the opposite of pregnancy. Pregnancy may be somewhat protective. Low vitamin Ds may be somewhat increase the risk, it sounds like.
Right. Well, the vitamin D itself, in other words, vitamin D is, appears to be a good thing if you don't have enough of it.
That, right.
And let me offer a comment that vitamin D is not a treatment for MS, and it's not something that people can just go out and start taking lots of, because too much vitamin D certainly can be toxic.
Yeah.
So we want to make that point.
So there's a tendency for humans to jump to conclusions here about the prevalence or association and causation, for example. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry, did I interrupt you?
Oh, no, so I was just going to say, if any of your listeners with MS have a question about their vitamin D levels, their doctor can certainly check it. If their levels are low, it may be appropriate to provide some supplementation under medical supervision.
Okay. We have a caller. I want to take Anna. You're on line one. What can we do for you?
Good afternoon. I'm a long-term MS patient with relapsing remitting MS, and my question has to do with age factors. Has there been any studies that been done that as a patient ages and the fact that you are getting older can increase MS symptoms or aggravate MS symptoms? Or are there times when you don't know whether you're having a bad day because it's MS or you're having a bad day because your arthritis hurts?
Mm.
I think you bring up a very good point, and I'm not sure that we know the answer to that. Certainly there isn't an increased incidence of MS as people get older. And I think sometimes it is hard to tell if you're having an MS symptom or if you're just having a bad day because the parts are wearing out. So I think this is an area that we need some more investigation on in the MS population. For an individual patient, you know, sometimes you can tell whether it's an MS thing or not.
Okay. Well, it's one of the things that I'm getting to look at as I reach retirement age. And I'm moving somewhere warmer where there's more vitamin D. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. If you have questions or comments, you can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@kska.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and talk with Dr. Barbara Geiser. She's clinical professor of neurology and clinical director of the Multiple Sclerosis Program at UCLA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Barbara Geiser. She is the clinical director of the Multiple Sclerosis Program at UCLA. She's had almost 30 years of experience dealing with patients with multiple sclerosis. If you've got questions or comments, you can call us at 550-8433 or at our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Of course, you can also email us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. And just remember, if you're listening in Anchorage between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be available, so you need to do it in the next 30 minutes or so if you've got some questions or comments. Has the prevalence of multiple sclerosis increased over the last, let's say, 50 years or some period of time where we can honestly say that there may have been a change one way or the other?
My short answer to that question is I don't know. I think most people would hold that it's not that the prevalence is actually increasing, but I think we've got more tools to help us diagnose it. MRI has been around for just under 30 years. We have electrical tests called evoked potentials. We have tests to rule out other conditions, as I said, like HIV or Lyme disease. So I'm not sure the prevalence has increased. It just and public awareness, of course, has become a lot better. So I think perhaps people maybe get into their doctors a little earlier.
Yeah. So this is a common problem with autism and many things. We just got this diagnostic bias kind of issue. It makes it difficult to be sure. We have a couple of phone calls now coming in. Let's go ahead and take one. Kristen is on line 3. What can we do for you? Kristen?
Hi. I wanted to ask the doctor, I have had relapsing remitting MS, but it was kind of an odd case because I had my first attack at age 32, you know, numbness and all of that. And when it went away, I didn't have another attack until 15 years later in my early 50s. And the second attack left me with some deficits that I didn't have before. But my question is, you know, looking into this, I'm sure that you've heard of this study, Dr. Zamboni from Italy, whose wife came down with MS, and he began looking at alternative treatments. And they are doing a study somewhere in New York on the neck veins. They have found that when they check not the arteries but the veins in patients who have MS, that all of them have had blockages in the veins in their neck, and that when they do surgery, these people have either completely recovered apparently from their symptoms so far or have had vast improvement. And I wanted to know what you know about this study and what you think about it.
Okay, that's a very good question because this has been all over the media lately, and what you're referring to is what's called CCSVI, chronic
right.
cerebrospinal venous insufficiency. But the initials are a little bit easier to say than that. And you're right, Dr. Zamboni, who's not a neurologist, by the way, I believe he's a vascular surgeon, maintains that that people with MS have this blockage in the veins that drain the brain, and this blockage is what leads to the nerve damage. And he claims if you open up the veins that this improves symptoms. This is very controversial. This is by no means anything that's proven. And in fact, a week or so ago, the National MS Society just committed almost $2.5 million to do controlled studies to look at this. Mm-hmm. This is not something that's been subjected to a controlled study yet, but it's important to investigate this. So there are a couple of studies going on where they're going to study this in a controlled fashion and see if they can in fact establish that this blockage is responsible for the nerve damage, which is not at all clear at this point, and if so, if you treat the blockage, if it improves people's symptoms. But this is a very controversial thing right now.
Okay, well, that's encouraging to me that they are looking into this because it sounds like they have had some success with it. So I was just wondering what you thought about that. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, and again, let me clarify. The success has been reported in uncontrolled trials, and the reason that we make a point of that when we discuss treatments in MS is, as you know, people with relapsing remitting MS often get better sometimes if you don't do anything. That's why it's called relapsing remitting. And so if you're going to test a treatment for MS, especially in relapsing remitting, you've got to have a control group so you can show that people wouldn't have gotten better anyway. So, as I say, the MS Society just funded several studies, and I think over the next couple of years, hopefully, we'll get an answer as to whether this is an appropriate treatment and an appropriate pathophysiology. The other thing to remember is that while a large number of the people that they studied with MS had this blockage, this blockage also occurs in other neurologic conditions that aren't MS, and it occurs, I think, in some studies in almost 30% of healthy people.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a slam dunk cause and effect yet.
Right. All right. Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Let me also editorialize and then about this issue or similar issues, and then Dr. Geister, I ask you to comment. This is the kind of thing that is extremely common in medicine, where we get preliminary evidence of something and a lot of excitement both in the professional community and sometimes in the public, and often after close scrutiny, it fails to meet the expectations. And so my editorial comment would be very, very cautious about this kind of issue until there are much better, as you said, control studies done.
I can't do anything but agree with that. And I would also encourage people, if they want to find out about this, to go to an appropriate, accurate source, such as the National MS Society, to get accurate information.
Okie doke. Rebecca, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I have had multiple sclerosis for 7 years, fibromyalgia for 6, and in December of 2008, I was diagnosed with lupus or a lupus-like connective tissue disorder. I'm only 30, and I'm actually, oddly, probably the healthiest I've ever been. Because now I take care of myself really well. Not that I didn't before, I just now actually know my body like the back of my hand. My question is I guess I left out one of the most important parts. I have primary progressive MS. I've had a very difficult time getting that diagnosed. Finally, at the Mayo Clinic, they agreed to diagnose it as multiple sclerosis, as opposed to relapsing or remitting, because I've never relapsed or remit. But so that's one question, is why is a primary progressive so difficult to diagnose? And why isn't there more research in primary progressive MS?
Okay, those are two very good questions and questions we get asked a lot. I will make a comment that you're a little unusual for having primary progressive MS, because generally the person who gets primary progressive is a little different than this sort of typical textbook person that I described earlier on. We said most people who get relapsing remitting MS are young women in their 20s and 30s. Most people who have primary progressive are older men in their 30s and 40s. And the other thing about primary progressive is that it tends to affect the spinal cord more and that there's less brain activity. Now, it's not impossible for a young woman in her 30s to have primary progressive. It's just it's much less common. We don't have a test for it. We don't have a blood test or a spinal fluid test or an MR test. It's basically a clinical designation. And so, by definition, if you have the onset of symptoms that never go away and just relentlessly progress, then but by definition you're a primary progressive. But again, it's a historical designation. The reason there isn't more research on it is kind of two reasons, I think. One is because we're not exactly sure what makes this tick. We're not 100% sure what causes the nerve damage in relapsing remitting MS, at least certainly early on. Most of the nerve damage is caused by inflammation. And in primary progressive, you see less inflammation, but people are still accruing nerve damage. So we're not exactly sure what's going on there. The other thing is it's harder to design trials. I mean, one of the reasons that there are more clinical trials in relapsing remitting is, A, because it's much more common, that 85% of people who have MS start out with relapsing remitting. And the other thing is it's kind of easier to demonstrate endpoints, so you can count relapses. And if, you know, the people on your treatment have less relapses than placebo, you know, that's sort of easy to quantify. You can count inflammatory lesions on the MRI, you can look for inflammatory proteins. So it's a little bit easier to design outcome trials. It's a little harder to do.
Right.
So I think, and it's the least common form. We think only about 10% of everybody who has MS has primary progressive. So you haven't got a lot of patients. You're not quite sure what makes the lesion happen, and it's hard to design trials. So I think those are some of the reasons.
Oh, I'm sorry. One more question is there somebody or somewhere I can go to provide myself, my medical records, or something as a research subject? I mean, I really feel like I'm kind of wasted. Like, I've got a lot, I've figured out a lot, and my health is really good. I've managed as the symptoms have slowly and steadily progressed, and I feel like I've got the trifecta going on, and maybe someone can find that middle point that could help, you know?
Go ahead. I think it would depend what kind of research you're interested in. I would refer you to either the website of the National MS Society, which has a list of all the trials they're funding, and they are doing genetic studies and epidemiologic studies and things like that, and or you can go to the NIH website, clinicaltrials.gov, and you can look at all the MS trials and investigations that they're funding, and so you may see a trial that you would be interested in participating in.
Right. Most of them... I'm not relapsing remitting, so I can't be in them, and I have other autoimmune disorders, so it knocks me out of the park. So, yeah, I've tried. I feel like maybe I need to write a book or something. Thank you for all your help.
Well, good luck, Rebecca.
Thank you. Bye.
Kelly, you're on line one.
Thank you. I'm in the process of undergoing... diagnosis of possible MS, and my question is, I about 5 years ago, about 20 lesions were identified in my brain during an MRI that was incidental to something else, and because of my history, my doctor suspected possible MS, and because of the appearance on the MRI, sent me to a neurologist who took further blood tests and then wanted me to do a spinal tap, which I did not wish to do at that time and felt kind of in shock and in denial that I could have MS. So then this past year, I had more alarming symptoms for myself, and my care provider encouraged me to have another MRI taken, so I went ahead and did that, and there are additional 30 lesions that are in what I was told one of two patterns that are markers for MS. And then my spinal tap, I did have that done, and it came back negative. Where do you see me in the diagnostic process?
I cannot comment on that without seeing you and your MRI and your spinal fluid and your history. So I can't tell you if you have MS or not. I will make the comment that having normal spinal fluid does not rule out the diagnosis. Roughly 5 to 10% of people who absolutely have MS happen to have normal spinal fluid. So it's not a make or break thing. I guess my point is that you could have MS even though you have normal spinal fluid. But I there's no way I can tell you you have or you don't have it.
Right. Well, I understood that. I just was curious about how things are, you know, other possibilities are ruled out and eliminated, and, you know, then one finally comes to that diagnosis. So I know there's a process of, and there's criteria. It's kind of frustrating, though, because it seems so difficult to pin down, and I'm concerned about other things that could be causing a progressive lesions in my brain. So
Well, again, we kind of mentioned at the beginning of the program that there's what we call a differential. There are certainly other conditions that your doctors can test for, and you mentioned you'd had some blood tests and you had spinal fluid, so I assume they've looked for some of these. I think that's a good question to take up with your neurologist.
And that's something that is normally done, is it's the process of rolling out other things.
Yes.
And then with the history, the clinical picture, and then the two MRIs, and that's pretty much what they have to go on?
Again, it remains a clinical diagnosis. So you go on the history and the physical exam. You can bring in other evidence such as MRI or spinal fluid, or there's electrical tests called evoked potentials that are sometimes used. If you have any question about other conditions, you can test for those. So it's a process. But there isn't one thing that kind of makes or breaks this. I kind of wish there were. It would make things a lot easier for patients and for us.
And one other thing is age. I'm a lot older. I'm 56, and this first came to my attention at around age 50. So in looking back in my history, there's lots of things that could be attributed to a relapsing, remitting MS over the years, but it has been evidently a slow progression. Is that something that's common, or...
I'm sorry, is it common to have symptoms start to get worrisome at age 50, or I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Well, is it common for someone to go undiagnosed for that long?
I've certainly seen it.
Yeah.
I've certainly seen it.
Okay, thank you.
Look, Kelly, let me ask what maybe for me an pertinent question. I mean, you're obviously seeing a neurologist here that's unclear of the diagnosis, so... Dr. Geisner, would it make sense to perhaps see someone like yourself at a facility where that's all you're doing day to day and may have a little bit more breadth of experience?
I think that's a good question. Sometimes it helps to see an MS specialist, and sometimes there isn't anything we can add. So,
right.
I think it's a reasonable suggestion, but we don't always come up with the right answer.
Yep. Okay,
we may not have anything additional to add to what the community neurologist has already done.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, Kelly. What's the natural history of untreated multiple sclerosis? I know the answer is going to be, it's all over the park, it seems like, but I want to talk about treatment a little bit, and so we want to have some baseline with which to measure whether our treatments are successful or not.
Sure, and that's a great question. And we've had disease-modifying therapy for MS since 1993. That's when the first agent was introduced. And even though that's almost 20 years, that's actually not that much time. We certainly know, I think almost everybody would agree, that people who go on disease-modifying therapy have less relapses than people who don't. There's also data that indicate that if you don't take disease-modifying therapy, you're more likely to increase your lesion burden on MRI than people who don't take the disease-modifying therapy. So certainly clinically and radiologically, people on the drugs tend to do better, at least early on in the disease. What's a little bit controversial, what hasn't been definitively proven, is if you decrease relapses and decrease inflammation early on, do you end up better down the line? And that's not entirely clear. Some people say yes, some people say no. But I think in terms of decreasing relapses, decreasing missed time at work, improving quality of life, and minimizing the lesion burden early on, certainly I think people tend to do better on treatment than off. Now, that's just disease-modifying therapy. The other arm, the other class of treatment for people with MS is symptom modification. And symptom modification doesn't do anything to alter the natural history, but it certainly makes people feel better and function better. So what I like to impress upon the people I see is that it's kind of like apples and oranges. There are therapies to help modify the disease, and there are therapies to help you feel better, and they kind of go hand in hand.
Well, let's talk about some of those.
So in terms of the disease-modifying therapies, these immunomodulators that I alluded to, again, these have been around since 1993. There are now seven, at least in this country, FDA-approved immunomodulating therapy, sort of six immunomodulators and one immunosuppressant. And basically, these are a couple of different brands of an immune protein called beta interferon. Beta interferon is a naturally occurring immune protein, and it has immunomodulatory effects. There are a couple of different brands of that. There is a non-interferon, an agent called Copaxone, glutiramer acetate, which is a synthetic protein-like substance, if you will. That's also an immunomodulator. There is a monoclonal antibody. That's an antibody that's produced to some naturally occurring proteins that has immunomodulatory effects. That's natalizumab. And there is an immunosuppressant drug, a chemotherapy drug that has an FDA indication for certain more severe forms of MS. But for people that are newly diagnosed, people with relapsing remitting, we would generally recommend one of the interferons or the glutiramer.
And how do these medications work?
Well, again, they have different specific mechanisms of actions, but basically in people with relapsing remitting MS, what they do is they interfere with the immune system's ability to attack the nerves and get into the nervous system and cause inflammation and damage. So what they've been shown to do in the best case is reduce relapses by around a third. They reduce the presence of inflammatory lesions on MRI, but for some of them by up to 80%. They do have some effect on progression.
Okay. And the obvious next question, or the most common next question, would be side effects. What's the risk? And then let's talk about the risk-benefit ratio and how you discuss this with patients.
Yeah. Well, again, speaking now just for the interferons and glutiramer, what we call our sort of platform immunomodulatory agents, the nice thing is, as I say, these drugs have been around for almost 20 years. They all have a very nice long-term safety record. So there are some side effects that are specific to each drug, which I won't go into, but basically there are some patients started on the clinical trials of some of these drugs in the late 80s. They've been on them for 20 years. There are long-term studies with all of these agents that indicate that long-term they're generally safe. They need some monitoring. But they're generally pretty safe drugs, and about 90% of people who take them tolerate them very well. So in the trials and in my own experience, it's usually only about 1 in 10 people who just can't tolerate these drugs. Now, the immunosuppressant agent, which is a chemotherapy drug, has a little more of a side effect profile, but again, that's not a drug you would start somebody newly diagnosed on. That's an agent that you would serve for somebody with more progressive disease or somebody who's failed the first-line agents. Also, the monoclonal antibody, the natalizumab, is not something that you would start somebody on right off the bat. You would reserve that for somebody who isn't doing well on those agents. That agent has to be monitored because there's approximately a 1 in 1,000 incidence of a very rare but very serious brain infection. And so that agent has to be monitored very closely. But I would say for all of these agents, again, some a little bit more than others, there's a very acceptable risk-benefit ratio. And almost all of my colleagues, when they see people that are newly diagnosed with relapsing remitting MS, we encourage early treatment. Again, we certainly know that we buy time for people early on, up front in the course of the disease. And the other thing that we know is that by the time people get diagnosed, this process has been going on for a while. And MRI studies tell us that even in between exacerbations, even when people are not having symptoms, this is an ongoing active process. And so we really want to jump on it and beat it back. So we encourage early diagnosis and early treatment.
Before we came on the air again, you asked that we address this question about how to help people with MS live well and help themselves. So in our last 4 to 5 minutes here, let me ask you to comment on that.
Thank you, because I think that's really important. And like I said, for example, in the bad old days, we used to tell people with MS, women with MS, not to get pregnant. And in fact, now not only do we encourage them to get pregnant if they want, but we're testing a pregnancy hormone. Our program under the direction of Dr. Rhonda Voskal is testing a pregnancy hormone as a possible treatment for multiple sclerosis. People with MS used to be told not to exercise, and now we know that exercise is one of the best things anybody with MS can do. So we encourage people to be active, to exercise, to work with their neurologist, to get on treatment, to monitor their disease, and really to be knowledgeable, to know their symptoms, to treat things before they become severe. The majority of people that I see that are newly diagnosed really lead very full, active lives. But I think that's how I would encourage people to approach this disease. We can't cure this disease yet. We can't stop it yet. But we can certainly control it, treat it, modify it, and help people live with it. And I would encourage them to take advantage of all the options we have and work with their doctors.
We have one more caller. I want to remind both the caller and yourself. We have about 2.5 minutes or so. Russ, you're on line one.
Okay, thank you. I just had a quick question. If the doctor could talk about what, if any, research has been done on dietary contributions to autoimmune diseases like MS and lupus, and whether or not diet has been looked at as a possible disease-modifying therapy as well, in addition to these drugs.
Okay.
I can't comment on the other autoimmune diseases. That's not my specialty. I will confine my comments to MS. And right now, again, it's kind of hard to do these studies. There are no proven dietary interventions that have been shown to alter the course of MS. Having said that, there are some preliminary data that indicate that omega-3s, fish oils, there's some studies in animals, there are a few studies in people, there's some epidemiologic data that indicate that those oils may have an anti-inflammatory effect. There's the vitamin D data that we mentioned. So there are beginning to be some studies that are coming out for dietary manipulations, but no special diet, no diet that excludes large groups of things or follows a strict dietary regimen has been shown to date to, in a properly controlled study, to alter the course of MS. But I think this is sort of stay tuned in this area, because we are finding out more about this.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call, Russ. We got about a minute. I like to sometimes leave this to our guest to make some final comments, final thoughts that you want to leave with our listeners.
I'd like to say that I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and talk with your listeners. What I tell my patients is there's certainly no good time to be diagnosed with MS, but if you have to be diagnosed with MS, now is sort of the best time there's been. We know more about it. We've got pretty good safe treatments. We're just on the cusp of getting even better treatments. And we're helping people to live with this, and there's lots of proactive things that they can do to maximize their health and function.
Well, I really want to say thanks for taking the time and lending us your expertise. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, Dr. Geiser.
It's been my pleasure, Dr. Woodard. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to do this.
All right. You have a good evening.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks again. Dr. Geiser is the clinical professor of neurology and the clinical director of the multiple sclerosis program at UCLA. Next week, we'll be back. We're going to be taking a look at prostate cancer, a little bit different look. We're going to be talking with Michael Diefenbach. He's a PhD. He's a psychologist involved with the urology program at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and he's interested in clinical decision-making and how patients go about making decisions. And he has three very important questions all men need to ask their physicians about prostate cancer, which will get us started. So why don't you join us next week? Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Dave Waldron engineered today's program. Josh Edge manned the phones for us. And I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.